Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. Later in the program, we're going to be talking to Randall Marco about recycling. I'd like now to introduce former United States CIA Operations Officer Valerie Plame Wilson, and joining us by telephone, former Ambassador Joe Wilson. The film Fair Game, which opened this weekend in Santa Fe, is based on Valerie's book Fair Game and Joe's book The Politics of Truth. And in the film, they are played by Naomi Watts and Sean Penn. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Nice to be here.
So this film covers the period during the Bush-Cheney era when the White House was basically looking for reasons to invade Iraq. And each of you separately was uncovering intelligence firsthand that made it pretty clear that their much publicized intelligence, like the story about the aluminum tubes and the yellow cake from Niger, were false. They were false pretexts. And a film of this kind is necessarily fictionalized in some details, but basically, does it get the facts right?
Yes, both of us believe that it is a very accurate portrayal of what happened. Obviously, it is a Hollywood movie, so timeline has been consolidated. There's been condensing of certain pieces. Of course, you know, you have to. It has to have an entertaining narrative, and you have to tell the story in about an hour and 45 minutes.
Right.
But no, it gets the essential truth right. I want Joe to speak to his piece, but I just want to say, as far as what I was doing in the run-up to the war, I didn't go in thinking whether Saddam Hussein had a WMD program or not. That wasn't my job. My job was to see what was there. We had very thin intelligence when the administration turned its attention to Iraq right after 9/11. And my job and my former colleagues was to figure out what was going on. What was the state of their research and development? How were they procuring material and so forth? Joe came at it from obviously a different perspective.
Yeah, I think it wasn't so much what we uncovered as what we didn't uncover, or what I didn't uncover. There was this allegation that there was a contract of covering uranium sales from Niger to Iraq, and I went out there and was able to determine, as had others who had been there before me, that there was simply nothing to substantiate this allegation, that it was just basically, as it later turned out, the documents that prompted my trip were later determined to have been forgeries. In fact, I think the deputy director of the International Atomic Energy Agency said that anybody with Google, with access to Google, would have found out they were forgeries in about 20 minutes. So, I mean, it was a very serious business trying to figure out whether Saddam had weapons of mass destruction or was reconstituting his nuclear arms program. And I think, certainly from my perspective, I came away understanding that whatever else he was doing, he was not, in fact, in Africa trying to buy uranium yellow cake.
For those of us who were at that time on the outside watching what looked an awful lot like lies and deceit, not being able to do anything about it, it brought on a huge sense of powerlessness. There were marches all over the world, untold millions of people trying to prevent this war. Here you are both on the inside at fairly high levels, equally powerless. Did you, I mean, Joe, for example, before you wrote that famous editorial, which was several months into the war, did you feel that there was anything that you could do to prevent a needless war and invasion?
Well, I think it's important to understand that nobody really realized, or certainly I didn't realize, until March 12th or 13th, that the allegation of uranium sales to Iraq that were contained in the President's State of the Union address pertained to Niger. Because there are other uranium producers in Africa, and I had only looked into one specific case. So it was only in March, which was literally 3 or 4 days before the war started. So it was very clear at that time you weren't going to be able to prevent, 36 hours before the president gave his ultimatum, you weren't going to be able to prevent what initially happened. I will say this, people who followed this closely, the debate, will know that there were a few of us. There was Brent Scowcroft, myself, Tony Zinni, Jim Baker, the former Secretary of State, all of whom weighed in during the debate on what U.S. policy should be towards Iraq. And basically at that time, the debate was not so partisan as it was a debate between those who had done the first Gulf War and those who were ideologically driven, so pragmatists versus ideologues. And we fought that battle up until, you know, February of 2003, but we were defeated by the president, by the administration, and by the arguments that they made to persuade Congress to pass that resolution. The great tragedy of all this, of course, is that the arguments they used to persuade Congress were bogus. Now, a lot of that, and I'll conclude with this, a lot of that responsibility should weigh very heavily on the congressmen and women who voted for the resolution, because many of them voted without ever having read thoroughly or studied thoroughly the underlying analysis that Saddam, in fact, posed a strategic threat to our national security, which was contained in the National Intelligence Estimate. Had they read it, there was much reason to believe that war wasn't the only option.
Valerie, how did you respond? I mean, you're working for the CIA. It's everything you're doing is secret and classified, and there you are. What was the knowing that there's a misuse of intelligence going on and being right in the thick of that? How did you and your colleagues talk about this at the workplace?
I'd like to open up. I'm really taken by your opening question to Joe on this, was the sense of the public was feeling quite powerless and we didn't really know what was going on. And I think, ironically, that is actually the roots of what we're seeing manifested now in the Tea Party, that sense of government's out of control, we've been lied to, manipulated. It has emerged, of course, on the far right. But I think it is ironic that I think it was fed, its legacy goes back to those, certainly to the pre-Iraq months and you know, right after 9/11. As for me personally, I was running an operational task force, trying our damnedest to get to these scientists and understand what was going on. My head was, as I call it, you know, in the operational weeds, trying to make sure my operations were secure, effective, making sure I had an Arabic speaker over here and so forth. So it wasn't until then Secretary of State Colin Powell's speech before the UN, which was about 3 weeks before we went to war, his speech was February 2003, that I and my colleagues watched that his performance at the UN with, I think all of us were deeply troubled, at least those that I was standing there with watching this, because we realized what he was saying, and he, of course, his reputation was sparkling, and everyone wanted to hear what he had to say, how he was going to defend this decision to go to war. And as he was speaking, it was very, very clear that the intelligence that he was using was deeply flawed. And it didn't, you know, his arguments didn't match up to what we knew. And that there was a perception gap between, you know, the administration's rhetoric and what the real intelligence was showing. So that, for me, was the first time that I experienced a deep sense of unease of, you know, and you just, at that point, you just hope that, wow, I hope that there are people way higher, you know, in the pay grade that have intelligence that would support going to war.
When you, Valerie, were outed as a CIA agent several months later, when there was this leak to the press after Joe published this article talking about what he didn't find in Africa, in Niger, and, of course, the reason the film is called Fair Game is because apparently Karl Rove said that Joe Wilson's wife is fair game. And so they did this unbelievable thing, which was outing a CIA officer. And everybody who was watching it said, oh, my God, if a Democrat had done that, they would be hanging by their neck in a jail cell somewhere. But this guy got away with it. What dangers were posed to you and your family and to the people with whom you had active relationships in Iraq?
Mm-hmm. Well, not just Iraq, of course.
Yeah.
My entire network of assets. And when you think, of course, it's even those with whom I had a completely innocuous relationship, foreigners overseas, because, of course, they fall under suspicion now that I am known CIA. Okay, you know, so I lost my job. I could no longer do the covert job for which I've been highly trained. Okay, that's sad for me, but there's also the ripple effect. If someone is out there, a foreigner with perhaps critical intelligence that he's thinking about sharing with the United States, and he hears his story, he says, now why would I jeopardize myself and my family when they can't even protect one of their own? But make no mistake, Mary Charlotte, both Joe and I are very cognizant of the fact of no matter what happened to us, from the smear campaign and the loss of my career and so forth, that is mere inconvenience, and we know it, compared to the sacrifice made by the men and women in both Iraq and Afghanistan, that have paid the ultimate sacrifice for foreign policy decisions made by our leaders.
Meaning the soldiers who
the
got
soldiers,
killed
yes.
needlessly
yes.
in this crazy war.
Or, yeah, and think of the hundred, as we know now, tens of thousands of Iraqi civilians.
If not hundreds of thousands.
Yeah, where the numbers are still coming to light.
Right. This film, and I believe that every man, woman, and child over the age of 10 should see it. It's called Fair Game. No, really, it's also a great film. We'll talk about that in a moment. But it's as much as anything about the abuse of power and the ability of the powerful to get what they want without regard to law, justice, human rights. After the really egregious wrongs committed against both of you during the Bush era, ending in a failed lawsuit, you never received the justice or vindication you were looking for. Starting with you, Joe, what purpose does this film fulfill for you?
Well, I think, first of all, I obviously the judicial system was looking for justice after Mr. Roe, and Mr. Armitage leaked Valerie's name, which was a crime. And secondly, vindication is not a reason that underpinned our going to the courts. We wanted the truth out. We wanted people to be held accountable for their actions. And most importantly, what we wanted out of our civil suit was to establish a precedent that public officials in the future would not be immune from response if they were using their publicly funded position of public trust as a perch from which to engage in a private political vendetta. So those are the rationales for doing it. As far as I'm concerned, the movie really is a much more timeless story of power, the abuse of power, and what needs to be done in order to stand up to power and the consequences of doing so. But obviously, power and checks on power have been overriding subjects of American political discussion since the founding fathers drafted the Constitution of the United States, which is all about power and how to check power and keep it from being so overwhelmingly arrogant that those in positions of power can do to American citizens what they did to us. So that's basically what the fight was all about, and I think the film recounts that very well, and I hope what people take away from it is, geez, if Wilson can stand up to power, certainly we can as well. And standing up to power at all levels, whether it's Mayor Koss, the city council, our state representatives, or federal level, is what's going to keep the republic strong. It is really holding government to account and making sure that those officials in public positions know they work for us rather than vice versa.
Anything to add, Valerie?
I agree. No, in this time and this environment where politically our country is so deeply polarized, and an important, it seems that democracy is more fragile than we really understand or know, how important it is to have an educated electorate to pay attention. I think it was Bell, California, where the city managers were quietly, stealthily giving themselves raises of close to $1 million until finally someone said, what's going on? So it's across the board.
How did this film come about? Was it your idea or were you guys approached?
Well, as you noted, it's based on both of our books, and we were approached by the producers. We had, as it turns out, we had a mutual friend who facilitated that. And we certainly didn't write our books with this notion in mind. Writing the books, I think, for both of us was quite a selfish sort of catharsis to try to understand what happened. Joe wrote his in 2004, and I wrote mine in 2006 and 7, so different times in this whole little story. But they approached us about making the movie, and films do have a way of reaching people in a very visceral way, and we're delighted that it helps set the record straight.
What were both of your roles in the development of the screenplay and then the production of the film?
Well, we were consultants. We were consultants on the film. We took turns being on the set. The screenplay was written by two brothers, Jez and John Henry Butterworth, and they drew upon our books, upon the vast amount of information available in the public domain. I think they sat through almost every day of Scooter Libby's trial in Washington, D.C. They interviewed, they were really very aggressive in their researching and so forth. So we helped where we could. Obviously, I'm prescribed from, any sort of sources and methods, and I would never want to reveal anything that was jeopardize national security, but they have plenty to work with.
Now, in your book, which we talked about when it came out, Valerie, Fair Game, there was a lot of it was redacted, and I love that the publisher printed the book with big black marker lines through the parts that you weren't allowed to put in. But would you say that this film is comparatively uncensored compared to the book?
Oh, yes, completely different issue altogether. The agency, in the case of the book, the agency has taken the position that I am not permitted to acknowledge my agency affiliation prior to 2002. So most of those redactions, a vast majority, have to do with the fact that I did or did not exist before 2002, rather than anything to do with national security. It was clearly further retaliation and an attempt not to have the book not from being published. So that was one thing. The movie, on the other hand, they are exempt. They did not sign the secrecy agreement with the CIA, so they are free to adapt and change and make it create their own.
We're talking to Valerie Plame Wilson and Joe Wilson. Another character in the film is the right-wing media, which comes off as being devoid of journalistic integrity and even the remotest tendency toward any kind of investigation. It's vindictive, it's full of hatred. It's another reminder about how central to democracy the media are. I wanted to start with you, Joe. What is to be done about this right-wing media problem?
Well, I think the two issues are separate. One, I think we do have a right-wing media problem, and I think we also have a rabid left-wing media problem. But more to the point, in the case of this story, it really is the media broadly that let the country down. Or at a minimum, you could say the Washington media, those who are paid to cover the national and federal government. I attribute that I don't attribute it. I've had reporters here in Washington tell me that essentially the Washington press corps has abrogated all of its responsibilities in order to maintain access. So they put access to the powerful above investigating the powerful. And as one journalist said to me, they all have mansions in Potomac. They all drive BMWs, and they all have their kids in private schools, and they're not going to jeopardize that lifestyle by running afoul of the likes of Karl Rove or Scooter Libby or the people in power. So that in the story recounts, while there is a couple of right-wing media sort of vignettes in it, I think more broadly it was the media in general that let us down. As a country, not just Valerie and me or this investigation. Had the media been doing its job, perhaps we would have had a more spirited debate in the run-up to the war.
What do you mean by we have a left-wing media problem? I mean, when I look at, Democracy Now!, which is running on a shoestring, and they investigate everything to the nth degree, and the Fox News don't even bother to open the websites of the people they're talking about. I mean, they're not really parallel.
Well, it may well be, but presumably, if there were an audience and a willingness to support democracy now the way there's a willingness to support Fox News, then you would certainly have a more vigorous budget. But what I really mean is that opinion and punditry has taken the place of good journalism, independent journalism,
and investigation.
And you certainly see that on all the news, all the cable news programs, where it really is opinions pitted against each other, whether those opinions are steeped in facts or just steeped in ideology.
Right.
And that's on both sides.
I can't remember who it was recently said, you're entitled to your own opinion, but you're not entitled to your own facts.
Well, the first one in my memory who said that was Senator Moynihan.
Right.
And so, and that's been, yeah, people often quote him on that. And, mm-hmm. and it's absolutely right. You're entitled to your opinions, but not your own set of facts. And the trouble is people come up with these opinions and they claim they're rooted in facts. And nobody does the fact checking.
Yeah.
The moderator or the commentator, whether it's Chris Matthews or whether it's Sean Hannity. Although Chris does do a little bit more of digging in, but it really is being able to hold these people's opinions to the fire.
We're looking now at $1 trillion. Expenditure on war since George Bush took office in 2001. Three quarters of that is in Iraq. The economic problems that we're having in this country now are never linked to this. Should they be?
This is just my opinion. When you look at the budget, you have to look at it holistically. I was very gratified to see that even the defense secretary, Robert Gates, has spoken about the need to reduce defense spending. I think it's obvious, and yet if the Democrats holding office, it's like the third rail. Heaven forbid that they should suggest that there be reductions in our defense spending, because then they're called weak on defense.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
I think, you know, getting back to the wars, I was just I'm here in Washington, D.C. today, and last night I was at a reception on Arab National Day, for Oman. And I ran into a lot of my former colleagues in the diplomatic service, both American diplomats and Arab diplomats based in Washington, and spent quite a bit of time talking to people. I have to tell you, the general consensus among those who live in the region and those of us who have lived and served in the region is that neither of these wars are in our interest, nor are they in the interests of the countries that we're speaking about. And the sooner we can bring our own people home, I think the better. The odds of our being successful in future relations with the countries of Iraq and Afghanistan as a consequence of this heavy-handed occupation presence in both countries are slim and none. So the sooner we can bring our folks home, I think the better off we'll all be.
I have to ask you, is this film going to be seen in Iraq?
I don't know if it'll be seen in Iraq, but I'll tell you that, if I go back to Baghdad, I was just in Baghdad last month, and the next time, if I go back, which I may well do, I certainly will take a DVD with me and show it to anybody who wants to see it. But it did open at the Abu Dhabi Film Festival about 3 weeks ago, and apparently during the Q&A session afterwards, the question and answer session afterwards, an Iraqi stood up and told Doug Liman, the director of the movie, that he didn't think would ever be possible, but he actually felt at least as much sympathy for Valerie and me as he did for his own people. And you get comments like that, it's very emotional.
What was it like for each of you when you first saw the film and saw yourselves being played on screen?
I think Joe had a tear in his eye or so. We've seen it both a couple times in this final form. It is difficult every time. It really is. Seeing those scenes where the marriage is fraying. There's a scene where there's an Iraqi scientist and his son they're caught in gunfire seeing them wait for the, they think that the Americans, the CIA, will come and help exfiltrate them out of Iraq. A lot of the scenes are still difficult for us.
Valerie Plame Wilson and Joe Wilson are the subjects of the film Fair Game, which was directed by Doug Liman, who made The Bourne Identity. It has that same kind of quality of, mm-hmm. of cinematography mm-hmm. and pace.
You know, he's the son of Arthur Liman, who is a very, he's gone now, but very well-known attorney on the whole Iran-Contra, and very much a defender of civil liberties and so forth. So Doug, I know, was always trying to make a film that would make his father proud, and his father didn't live to see this one, but he knows this is a far cry from Mr. and Mrs. Smith and The Bourne Identity.
Right. Well, I want to thank you.
Yeah, if I could yeah. still distill down Doug's motives. His father believed very much in things like citizen responsibilities and citizens' rights, and a good part of his career was devoted to that. So I think for Doug to be able to tell this story is an homage to his own father's work in this area.
One more thing before we go. You talked about standing up to power, and when we show up here in Santa Fe at a city council meeting and talk about the location of garbage cans or the relocation of prairie dogs or whatever, we can have an effect. On this national level, we're about to enter this period of renegotiating a nuclear arms treaty, which is, by every account, the right thing to do. What can citizens do about something like that?
Oh, thank you, because this is something I feel passionately about, and it's really an extension of what I was doing covertly with the CIA, which is working on nuclear nonproliferation. So to set this up briefly, Presidents Obama and Medvedev signed this New START agreement in April. It needs to be ratified by the Senate. There have been dozens of meetings, of reports, of briefings for the Republicans. The Senate needs to ratify this. The Senate Republicans have essentially deputized Senator Kyle from Arizona to lead the charge. Everyone thought that this was going to be that everything had been agreed to, that it could be, in fact, ratified during this lame duck session of Congress. Just a few days ago, on Tuesday, Senator Kyle suddenly said, no, we're not going to do that. There's not enough time. That is, in my opinion, a completely bogus argument, because this has not been rushed through. Everyone's been briefed. Everyone understands. Yeah. And this, my sense is that it's Senator Kyle's way of taking away any sort of foreign policy victory from Obama. And make no mistake about it, this is absolutely an essential. Even people from on the right side of the spectrum, Henry Kissinger, and if Reagan were alive, he would completely support this as well, because what this does not only reduces our nuclear arsenal as well as Russia's, but it allows us to go in and peer around, open doors in Russia, and make so that we can remember, trust, yet verify. And that when you look at the facts, you can't, the only cogent, rational decision you can draw is that we need to ratify the START Treaty. So if your listeners,
citizens
should contact their senators and ask them to ratify the new START Treaty.
Valerie Plame Wilson and Joseph Wilson are the subjects of the film Fair Game, which is running in Santa Fe, New Mexico. Thank you both so much for being on the Radio Cafe.
Our pleasure.
Thanks.
Thank you
much,
so much.
Charlotte.
I'm happy now to welcome Rand Marco. He is the community relations
specialist.
I was going to say dude. with the Solid Waste Division for the city of Santa Fe. Welcome.
Oh, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
It's been a long time since we've had you on the air talking about recycling and trash and the landfill. How are we as a city of environmentally conscious people doing in the realm of recycling?
Well, as a city, we're pretty low on the totem pole, not just in the country, but in New Mexico. And we want to change all that.
How much do we recycle of the things we could recycle?
10% is what we recycle in Santa Fe.
So 90% of the recyclable stuff is going to the trash?
Is going to the landfill, yes.
That's so wrong.
Oh, absolutely. And again, I mean, if you saw what I see on a daily basis, you just want to maybe scream a little bit and say, why aren't we doing that? And I think one of the things that we need to do is, and what we're doing now through our Save a Ton program, which we'll probably talk about a little, is that we're bringing an awareness back to the city that cares.
What are we doing well so far? Are we recycling at least our beer bottles and stuff like that?
Well, not especially the beer bottles or the beer cans, but let me give you an example. If you drive down any street in Santa Fe during garbage day, Monday through Friday, let's say you'll see five or six people recycling instead of 20 or 30, and that's what we want to start focusing on, is the 20 or 30 that aren't doing it, and we want to encourage the people that are doing it to look and see what they're doing and throwing away, which may be recyclable.
What is recyclable and what is not recyclable? I know that plastics numbers 1 and 2, in theory, are recyclable, but then when you put your yogurt container in, they don't want it.
No.
Which is a plastic 1 or 2.
Well, look at the yogurt container next time you see it. It might be a 3 to a 7. And we don't have the capability in Santa Fe to recycle 3 through 7. We just have the capability to do 1s and 2s. And you have to remember, with a neck.
So
Very
why
important.
Is that?
It's the quality of the plastic that we're looking at. And that's why we can't use it here. We don't have a market for that coming out of Santa Fe. But we do for number 1s and 2s with necks.
So what should people do? Here we are on the radio. People are listening. They're driving to work. Maybe it's garbage day for their neighborhood. What should they do in the coming weeks?
The best thing they can do in the coming weeks
is
go online to the city's website, santafenm.gov/recycling, and you'll get a chart on everything we do and do not do and everything we take and do not take. And from that, you'll get a much better idea of what is recyclable within your household or within your business. And that'll probably double the amount that you're putting out at the street and take it out of the trash. Because our sole goal is to double the amount and take it out of the trash. If you're a business, you look at your waste stream going in, you know, starting at the dumpster where your garbage is, and work backwards to see where it's coming from and who's bringing it out there. So those can be taken usually to a receptacle that's right next to the dumpster. So instead of that employee throwing it in the dumpster, they're putting it in the recycling area, whether it's cardboard, plastic 1 and 2, newspaper, white paper, mixed paper, aluminum, tin. And when we get a tin can, let's say, that's from food, whether it's from the household or from the business, a hotel or whatever, restaurant, it needs to be rinsed out or wiped out. We don't want the food leftovers in the can, because that contaminates the whole load that our drivers had been picking up. So we don't want that at all. We don't want people putting their glass in the aluminum, tin, plastic, and paper, because that contaminates our load. And it doesn't take a lot to contaminate a load. You know, we don't want the cardboard with all sorts of foodstuffs on it, because that contaminates a pure load.
No pizza boxes.
No, we want the cardboard that looks like it has that honeycomb on it.
Yeah, the corrugated.
The corrugated cardboard.
As opposed to the six-pack cardboard.
The six-pack cardboard, the cereal boxes.
But you can't do this.
No. Any other types that are similar to that.
Now, the campaign is called Save a Ton, and the idea is to double what Santa Feans are recycling within the next year. That still won't bring us up to the national recycling average.
No, but that's a great start, because if we can double, we've done a great job in this city. And I think we can, as Santa Feans, get to that point. So if people go to greenlinesantafe.com, they'll be able to see the Save a Ton program. You can also go to facebook.com/saveaton. You can go to twitter.com and save a ton. You can also go to the santafenm.gov/recycling and see what's going on. So this will be an ongoing year project, not with all these .coms as well as the cities, and within the newspaper of the New Mexican. And the New Mexican every month will be highlighting different industries in our town. Like next month will be media, and coming in April it will be schools. And then there'll be hotel industry and the restaurants and the arts during the, you know, different times of the year. So we'll be highlighting those industries in the newspaper and on the websites. And if people want to Facebook us, right now I think we're over a couple hundred people liking the site.
Right, fans.
It's fans. We always like fans to like sites, you know. But if they want to put up a picture of good recycling or even bad recycling so we can know, that makes some changes, send those to the Facebook page.
Let's say somebody contaminates a load of recycling by putting crusty old tomato soup cans unrinsed in their recycling. What happens to the load that comes by the truck that comes early in the morning?
That's a great question. This is a problem that happens quite often. When our drivers come by and they look into your recycling and they say, you have done the right thing with the aluminum, with the paper and the glass, but the tin that's now mixed into the aluminum has tomato sauce in it. Well, what they're going to do is leave that whole container, put a sticker on that you should clean that out, or take the glass out, whatever the problem was, they're going to check a little box, and they'll come back the next week and they'll service the container. We don't want to take contaminated loads at all because, you know.
So you have some very vigilant dudes over there looking into each container.
Well, they're dumping thousands of containers every day, and they see it right away what's happening. If the owner's there, they may say something to the owner, but usually the owners aren't around. And they'll tag the thing, and then they'll go, and then they'll actually let us know in the office in case the owner calls in upset. We want to let the owner know what was going on. And we just don't do it for the homeowners. We do it for the businesses. Let's say there was contamination in a cardboard container from one of the businesses, and we didn't pick it up. So we call them to let them know what they're doing, and then we'll go back and pick it up.
That's really heavy-duty customer service, I must say.
Well, we're trying to be more, you know, vigilant with the customers and you know, find out what the issues are right away so we can solve the issues right away. And that's important to what we do.
So people need to basically, you know, I'm imagining that there's a kind of laziness that sets in, like it's just easier to throw out your cardboard than to take an X-Acto knife, and which I have one, by the front door and cut the stuff up and tie it up in a string. Or to do that. But when you think about it, it really doesn't take very long.
Oh, no. Oh, no.
And what people need to know to motivate them is, okay, it doesn't take very long, but it's still kind of a pain in the neck. What are the advantages to Santa Fe, to the environment, to them, of actually taking the few minutes to do it?
We're talking about just cardboard only. And cardboard is one of the biggest obstacles, not just for the homes, but for all the businesses, because every business has lots and lots of cardboard coming in on a basis almost every other day, or depending on the business. And when people have their cardboard all spread out over the place, we don't want to take it that way because we can't handle it that way. The trucks can't handle it that way. So we encourage them to, and what I would suggest as well as encouraging, is to have them, you know, pile it up during the week and then go ahead and bundle it. And make it easier for us to do our job. If they make it difficult for us to do our job, again, we'll tag it and let them know what they're doing wrong so they can do it right.
But what is the motivation? How is it going to make the world a better place?
Well, we're going to recycle that cardboard, and we're going to bring it back as other things. You know, more cardboard, most likely. It could be gone into paper products. So the whole idea of the recycling is not to go into the natural resources anymore, cutting down the trees, using up the water, using up manpower, you know, which is very costly on that end, and going and getting the used material, the recycled material, and reusing it and bringing it back. I'll give you an example. To make one tin can, one aluminum can, if you recycle one aluminum can, it's saving thousands of hours of electricity in a house, because the process of getting aluminum out of the ground is very costly. But to take all those aluminum cans, melt them down, and bring them back is not very costly compared to getting the raw materials out of the ground. And that's what we want to avoid in that respect.
And aluminum, I have to say, is one of the most recyclable materials ever. You can keep making cans into more cans, and
right,
you don't have to go down a level.
Well, and the same is true for glass, because glass is what? Sand, basically.
Yeah.
So you just keep recycling and recycling and recycling, you know, with the glass. With paper, it's a little different story, because the fibers tend to, let's say, get beat up in the process.
Mm-hmm.
So when they're really, if you look into the corrugated cardboard, you'll see little hairs in the corrugated cardboard. And if you look into your cereal boxes, there's actually clay and glue in the cereal boxes with very little of that good fiber in there. So that's what we don't want. We want the really good fibers so we can recycle that more and more and more.
Why are recycled paper products more expensive than the stuff that comes from cutting down trees in the Arctic forest, which is going to eventually release all its methane and make us all into
which
toast.
It probably already is, yeah. Well, the only thing I can say is that when you have recycled material, there's a certain cost to it. And as the more is done, and I've seen this happen over the years, the costs start coming down.
The more people recycle.
The more people, if people were recycling, you know, you have a little home office, you have white paper in there, you have your junk mail in there, magazines, newspaper, all that can be recycled. So the more of that we get, the less cost it's going to be.
Junk mail, that's something I wanted to ask about. On the old little recycling magnet that I used to have on my refrigerator, you couldn't put paper and junk mail in. Now you can.
Now you can.
And what about the plastic windows and stuff like
that? You can use the plastic windows, too.
You can put that on?
Because what we have at the transfer station is this giant separating machine that separates all these types of things and bales them up into these giant 5 foot by 5 foot by 5 foot cubes. And then those cubes get hauled off to market. But the separator, they throw in aluminum, tin, plastic, and mixed paper, and they do something with the machinery, and they only come out with the tin. Then they run it through again, and they only come out with the plastic. And then they run it again, and they come out with a number, you know, in paper products. Or they'll run nothing but white paper through. I mean, I'll give you an example.
And it'll take out your yellow paper?
Well, no, they'll run colored, you know, paper through as a bunch. But as far as white paper goes, I worked with the state, you know, really good people at the state, about looking at every building they have and what's going on in every building and what needs to change. You know, it was a mandate from the governor. And what happened was we started pulling out 7 to 7.5 tons of white paper only every week, and they reduced their trash by 60%. And we started taking all their cardboard away, which reduced the trash even more, you see. So that was well documented. So the state guys know how to document that way. And we found it was a lot, like 62 or 63% less going into the landfill. You know, and it cut back their, you know, this is another benefit to businesses is you recycle really well and watch your trash, it'll save you money.
Will it?
Oh, absolutely.
How do you actually fix that? So a person who's not recycling anything will end up getting a higher bill than a person who recycles everything they can?
Oh, absolutely. Let's say somebody has a dumpster and it's going 3 or 4 days a week and they're not recycling anything. So I'd come in and help them do a little audit, you know, where their trash and recycling. And let's say we can pull out 80% of what they're doing is now recycling. So that bill should be able to be cut in half or more.
And that actually happens.
That actually happens. So right now I'm working with a gal at the school system here in Santa Fe where we're looking at that for every school on every case. And there's volunteers within the schools, and they're helping us out to watch where it's coming from and where it's going to. And what we're finding out is they have like 60% cardboard and another 30% recycling, because all the kids are drinking and the cafeteria is doing with the tin and the plastic and the glass and everything. And we're now starting to discontinue certain trash pickups and doing a lot more recycling, which is saving them money in every single situation. So it does work.
Randall Marco does community relations with the Solid Waste Division here in the city of Santa Fe. So you're working with schools, with government offices, with businesses, with individuals, basically educating people as you're doing now on the radio about recycling.
Yes.
And the goal is to cut our garbage in half, double our recycling. Is that how it works?
Well, that's how ideally we would like it to work. I think we can do it. I think we can double our recycling efforts in the city. It may be below the average of the cities that are coming up, but not by much. And then the next year after that, look at it again and see what we're doing.
What's the motivation for individuals? As you mentioned, businesses can actually reduce the cost of having garbage taken away by recycling. What about houses?
Well, the houses right now, every household pays $12.58. You'll see that on your bill. Right? So the money incentive isn't there more than the incentive that this is what should be done because this is what we really need to do to create a different awareness to be environmentally sound within our city.
It's just called doing the right thing.
It's doing the right thing. So what does it cost you to do? It doesn't cost you any more or less, and maybe it costs you 5 more minutes of your time a week. So.
The Santa Fe recycling facility, state of the art, has these separators that are straight off of Star Trek and their ability to to do cool things.
Which they do. It's really amazing.
But what happens then? Okay, so you've got a stack, gigantic, unfathomable stack of white paper. Then you've got a different stack of cardboard. You've got a different heap of glass, a different heap of aluminum. What happens to it all? Where does it go?
Well, have you ever seen it run through the separator and what comes out on the other end?
No, we will have to take a field trip.
Well, I'm glad to, you know, make a field trip with you up to the transfer station. But what we do is we, as these things get bundled, and the Save a Ton program will be, on a trailer that banners will save a ton, and I'll probably be the one driving it around. So wave if you see me, please, and give me breaking room.
He's the handsome guy with the graying head of hair.
Yes, that's it. Thank you. But, they go to market where we sell the white paper at about $150 a ton.
Who wants this stuff?
Well, the different mills want it. And what they do is they process it out, and they bring it back. And I'll give you an example. The Santa Fe, New Mexican that has 100% recycled paper, when you get a paper in the morning and you read the paper and then you put it in the recycling, and on your day of service, the recycling guys come and pick it up, and it goes to the transfer, and it gets bundled up, and it goes to the mill, and it gets reprocessed. That process takes about 30 days to where you get that paper back on your doorstep. So that's an ongoing process that's happening. Huh.
So we no longer will have to call the paper edition of the New Mexico the dead tree edition.
No, let's not call it that anymore. Because it's really not.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a really big misnomer. Yeah. And it's also a misnomer that our guys throw out trash. I mean, they throw out trash. They throw out recycling, but they don't. If the load's constantly contaminated, we're going to throw it away so you can do it the right way the next time. You know, we get a lot of people like that, but, you know, those are misnomers that we'd like to correct and let people know we don't do that. We want the recycling. If they went to the transfer station, I'd love to take you up there and show you. We have mountains, and we have hundreds of these giant cubes that could be aluminum or tin or plastic or cardboard, and it's a huge production that's going on up there. I mean, the guys up there are doing a great job.
And I would like to make the offer right now. The first person who emails me at radiocafe@ksfr.org, who genuinely and sincerely would like to go with me to the transfer station to see all these separators. We are going to have a field trip. So some listener, if you want to come, please write to me and we will go up there probably after Thanksgiving.
Yes, that'd be great.
Rand Marco, anything else you want to let our listeners know?
Well, if they have any questions about recycling or about trash issues with the business or anything in their homes, or any concerns, please call us at 955-2200. That's the office number. Be patient with the girls because we're getting lots of calls every day, and not just about the new Save a Ton program, but all their issues within the city. And they'd be wonderfully glad to help you all out. If you need me, you can call the office and they'll transfer the call to me. And if you're a business and you need an audit of your trash, I'd be more than happy to come out and take a look and help you out because we're here to save a ton.
Exactly. Randall Marco is Community Relations Specialist with the Solid Waste Division for the City of Santa Fe. Once again, the number is 505-955-2200. Thank you so much for being with us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.
And you can also just Google Santa Fe Recycling, and that will take you to the site.
It'll santafenm.gov/recycling.
Right, but if you forgot that, you can just find it by Google, as I did the other time.
Oh, great. And I'd like to give a pitch to the greenlinesantafe.com, Facebook, Save a Ton, and Twitter at Save a Ton.
Excellent.
So thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte.
We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe radio cafe.org. Thanks to Doubtfoil Computer Services. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.